Hello, this is Tom Allen, and for the next hour, I'll be reading articles and features from the New York Times issue dated Tuesday, September 16th, 2025. Before I begin, I do want to apologize in advance if I mispronounce names of people or places, foreign or domestic. It is never intentional. Let's begin. The first article that I would like to read to you is titled Rubio in Israel says a diplomatic solution to Gaza war may not be possible. And the introductory paragraph reads, Secretary of State Marco Rubio met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel to discuss Trump's desire to see the war in Gaza end soon. And the article begins with a photograph of Mr. Rubio and Netanyahu at the Wailing Wall. The caption reads, Secretary of State Marco Rubio cast doubt on the possibility of a diplomatic solution in the Gaza war after talks with Prime Minister Netanyahu in Jerusalem began. This article was written by Michael Crowley. And the article begins, Secretary of State Rubio cast doubt on the chances of negotiating the surrender of the Palestinian militant group Hamas, saying during a visit to Israel on Monday that a diplomatic deal to end the war in Gaza might not be possible. Rubio spoke at a news conference alongside Mr. Netanyahu of Israel after the two men met for several hours. His comments struck a more pessimistic tone than that of President Trump, who earlier this month said that a deal to stop the fighting in Gaza could come, quote, very soon, unquote. While making clear that the United States would still pursue a peace settlement, Rubio said Hamas is a, quote, terrorist group, a barbaric group, whose stated mission is the destruction of the Jewish state. So, we're not counting on that happening anytime soon, unquote. His remarks were in harmony with those of Mr. Netanyahu, who reiterated that Israel, quote, must make sure that Hamas is eliminated, unquote. At the end of the news conference, Netanyahu said he would prefer a Hamas, quote, surrender, unquote, to continued fighting, if possible, while also saying that nothing about the status of negotiations with the group has really materialized. Rubio made clear that with regards to the war, quote, the president wants this to be finished, unquote, with the hostages released and Hamas defeated. Israel believes that about 20 hostages are still alive in Gaza. Hamas has shown no willingness to lay down to arm its arms. And Netanyahu, whom critics accuse of prolonging the war to extend his political career, shows no signs of compromising, if you will, in this pursuit of a total victory over Hamas. Some tensions have emerged between Netanyahu and Trump about the war, and Israel's recent strike against Hamas leaders in the Gulf nation of Qatar. The State Department announced that Rubio will travel to Qatar on Tuesday, today. Despite those tensions, Rubio and the Israeli premier seemed determined to present a unified front. Netanyahu said that it's, quote, it's obvious that Israel has no better ally than America. The American-Israeli alliance has never been as strong as it is now, unquote. Still, it remains unclear whether Netanyahu and Trump are in full agreement on the conduct of the war in Gaza. Eager to cast himself as a peacemaker, Trump has promised to broker a ceasefire deal that would free the remaining hostages. But his diplomacy has come up short, and Israel is now preparing a major military offensive in Gaza City, an offensive that is likely to prolong the fighting for months. There are growing signs that a ground invasion of Gaza City could begin soon. On Sunday, the Israeli military intensified airstrikes on the city and attacked four more high-rise buildings that it said were being used by Hamas. Both Rubio and Netanyahu dodged questions on Monday about whether they had discussed the planned offensive. Israel's leader defended its objective, saying that Gaza City was Hamas's most important remaining stronghold. He further said, quote, "We're going to take over and destroy the Hamas stronghold," unquote, Netanyahu said. Rubio had declined to say on Saturday whether Trump supports that goal. Israel has issued evacuation orders for the city, and more than 300,000 Palestinians have fled in the past 2 weeks, and that's according to the Israeli army. Aid organizations have warned that the displacement of hundreds of thousands more people to already crowded areas of central and southern Gaza will exacerbate the severe humanitarian crisis in the enclave, where hunger is rampant. Philippe Lazzarini, the Commissioner General of the UN agency that aids Palestinians, wrote on social media on Sunday as people were fleeing Gaza City, clogging the coastal road with traffic. He said, quote, "No place is safe in Gaza. No one is safe," unquote. Mr. Lorenzani added, quote, "More and more people are forced to leave, disoriented and uncertain, heading into the unknown." Gaza's civil defense, the Territory Rescue Service, has reported dozens killed in Gaza City over the past 2 weeks since Israel declared the large urban area a combat zone and began bombing in preparation for a full-scale ground assault. At their news conference yesterday, Rubio and Netanyahu condemned growing international calls for the recognition of a Palestinian state. The governments of Britain, France, Canada, Belgium, and Australia have all said in recent weeks that they will or may recognize such a state at the annual UN General Assembly gathering in New York next week. Let's move to a different article. The next article is titled, "White House Plans Broad Crackdown on Liberal Groups." The introductory paragraph reads, "Some of the highest-ranking officials in the federal government used Charlie Kirk's podcast, it was hosted by J.D. Vance, the vice president, to lay out their plans." This article, by the way, was written by Katie Rogers and Zolan Cano Youngs. This article begins, "Trump and his top advisors threatened on Monday to unleash the power of the federal government to punish what they allege was a left-wing network that funds and incites violence, seizing on Charlie Kirk's killing to make broad and unsubstantiated claims about their political opponents. Investigators were still working to identify a motive in the death of Kirk, Mr. Kirk, a prominent conservative activist who was shot last week in Utah. The Republican governor of Utah, Spencer Cox, has said that the suspect had a, quote, leftist ideology, unquote, and that he acted alone. But Trump and his top allies suggested that the suspect was part of a coordinated movement that was fomenting violence against conservatives, without giving any evidence that such a network existed. America has seen a wave of violence across the political spectrum, targeting Democrats and Republicans. Trump, who has downplayed violence from right-wing or other supporters, said that he would like to designate a a range of groups, including the loosely affiliated group of far-left anti-fascism activists known as Antifa, as domestic terrorists and bring racketeering cases against people funding their protest. Trump said, without naming any groups, quote, "We have some pretty radical groups, and they got away with murder," unquote. Unbelievable. He added that he was talking to the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, about bringing charges under the Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act against, quote, "some of the people that you've been reading about, people that have been putting up millions and millions of dollars for agitation," unquote. Trump did not specify who or what he was talking about. It was unclear on Monday evening, how these plans would unfold or how the White House could legally formalize such an effort without curbing First Amendment rights. Democrats have warned that the Trump White House could be using Kirk's killing as a pretense to go after political dissent, not just hate speech or violence. This next article is titled, "Used EV Sales Take Off as Prices Plummet." And the introductory paragraph reads, "Electric vehicles on the used market often cost less than the comparable gasoline models, making the technology affordable to many more buyers." And the article begins with a photograph of a woman in front of probably an e-car. And the caption reads, "Kay Boyle, a retired teacher who lives in San Francisco, recently bought a used Nissan Leaf she found on Craigslist for just $1,000 after factoring in a rebate from her electric utility company." Hey, this article is written by Jack Ewing, and the article begins, "New electric vehicles cost thousands more than similar models that run on gasoline. But a growing number of shoppers are discovering that for used cars, often the opposite is true. Used battery-powered vehicles often sell for less than comparable cars with internal combustion engines, making them a good deal, even before calculating savings and maintenance costs and fuel. That's expanding the number of people who can afford to buy such electric vehicles. Sales of used electric vehicles rose 40% in June from a year earlier, and that's according to Cox Automotive, a research firm. Kay Boyle, an 80-year-old widow who lives in San Francisco, recently bought herself a used Nissan Leaf, a vehicle she found on Craigslist for just about $1,000 after factoring in a rebate from her electric utility. Utility. The model from 2013 is not designed for long trips, but as its battery still has enough range to cover Boyer's trips to the grocery store, she's satisfied. Quote, "I was nervous at first," unquote, she said, a retired junior high school teacher who likened the car's instant acceleration to something that she might drive at Disneyland. Quote, "You just press it and it goes," unquote. "But now," she said, "I love this little car," unquote. Electric vehicles have lost value quickly, partly because rapidly advancing battery technology has made older models less attractive. A few years ago, most electric vehicles couldn't travel more than 200 miles on a charge. Now, cars that can go 300 miles are common, and within a few years, 400 miles will be the norm. Prices of new electric vehicles have also come down, with many selling for less than $40,000. That automatically pushes down prices of pre-owned cars. Used electric vehicles still make up just a sliver of the used car market, about 2% in July, that's according to Cox. Until a few years ago, there weren't many new electric vehicles to choose from, and very few were available used vehicles. But many people who bought the new Teslas, the Chevrolets, and the Nissans 3 or 4 years ago are ready to trade them in for newer models. Or their leases are expiring, and many of the cars are new enough that they'll still have years of warranty coverage left, reducing consumer concerns about just how long the batteries will last. Many people are also rushing to take advantage of a $4,000 tax credit, a credit that can be applied to used electric vehicles that sell for $25,000 or less. The credit, part of Biden-era measures, let me begin again, folks. The credit, part of Biden-era measures The credit, part of Biden-era measures to fight climate change, will expire at the end of September on a law signed by Trump. More than 800 people responded to a request by the New York Times to tell us their used vehicle experiences. Here's one or two I'll share right now. This is from Todd Albert. He purchased a 2022 Audi, and he paid $42,000. What a new model cost? $100,000 and up. Mr. Albert, an executive at a technology company in Florida, bought his 2022 Audi with 18,000 miles on the odometer last month. Their luxury sports sedan sells for well over $100,000 new. The Audi, which share many parts with the Porsche Taycan, had a reputation for being fun to drive, but losing value quickly. Mr. Albert said the biggest drawback to both GT and Taycan, from my research, is a rapid depreciation. If you buy it used, that's the best thing about it. Mr. Albert loves the Audi so much, he said, that he sometimes sits on the balcony of the home in Delray Beach gazing at it parked below. Quote, "The best word I can use is obsessed," he said. Quote, "I fall asleep at night thinking about it." I think I'll end the article at that point. And you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 16th issue of the New York Times here on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. This next article is titled, "In a Chicago Neighborhood, Fear and Anger Over Trump's ICE, Quote, Blitz." And the introductory paragraph reads, "Pilsen, a part of the city's long home of Chicagoans of Mexican heritage, has grown quieter since the Trump administration announced an operation against illegal immigration." The article was written by Jasmine Ulo, and the article begins. The streets of the Pilsen neighborhood, a few miles southwest of downtown Chicago, are ordinary bustling in September with house parties and cookouts in the weeks surrounding Mexican Independence Day. But after the Trump administration announced the start of a crackdown on illegal immigration in Chicago, few of the usual vendors were hawking tamales or cups of elote in the neighborhood last week in Pilsen. People came out briefly for an annual parade, but hours later, only a single car was honking its way down 18th Street, waving the Mexican flags. Cashiers and business owners lamented that they were waiting for customers who never came. Residents of Pilsen, which has been home to Mexican immigrants to the Midwest for decades, said the threat of raids had upended their neighborhood. They spoke on undocumented relatives and neighbors who are now mostly staying at home, and of a broad sense of worry, but also of renewed solidarity. The Department of Homeland Security has focused on the Chicago area since last week as part of an effort that is calling Operation Midway Blitz. That operation has netted the arrest of several people, including some accused of robbery, assault, and other violent crimes, the agency said. In a Chicago suburb on Friday, an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer fatally shot a man during a vehicle stop after the man struck and dragged an officer with his car as he fled. That's according to the agency. Chicagoans throughout the city have been watchful for ICE agents and vehicles and reporting ICE activity to hotlines and websites that track the federal workers' whereabouts. Immigration advocacy groups said that since last week, they've seen an increase in the sighting of officers. In Pilsen, residents expressed anger at Trump at his new focus on Chicago after crackdowns in LA and Washington, and at his push to ramp up deportations. Many people who voiced frustration at Democrats who occupied the White House before Trump and at both parties, quote, failure for decades to fix what the residents see as an outdated and flawed immigration system, unquote. According to Carlo Romano, 52, a hair colorist and naturalized citizen from Mexico City, while eating some coconut milk outside an ice cream shop, said, quote, something has to break. Democrats throw the ball to Republicans, and Republicans throw the ball to Democrats, and there's no concrete solution to the problem, unquote. Chicago, a city of 2.7 million people, is one of the most diverse immigrant populations in the country, most of whom have legal status in the United States. About 625,000 Chicagoans are of Mexican origin. Demographers estimate that at least 150,000 people in the city are undocumented, and about a third of them are of Mexican origin. Mexican migrants began arriving to work in the city's stockyards and meatpacking plants as early as mid-1800s. Later, they came to work in steel mills and on the railroads that converge on the city. The neighborhood that became known as Pilsen was home first to Irish immigrants and later to German, Czech, Polish, and Italian immigrants. It started transforming into a hub of Mexican culture in the 1950s as the city began to deindustrialize and as development began to displace Mexican families from other parts of Chicago. Over the following decades, Pilsen became a center of Mexican-American political activity during the civil rights movement. Quote, we walked these streets until midnight, playing in the fire hydrant, going through the alleys, unquote, said Laurel Hernandez, 59, a legal assistant who grew up in Pilsen, part of the Lower West Side community, where more than 70% of the residents are Latino. Ms. Hernandez said her parents of Creole descent came from Louisiana, but her closest childhood friends, many of whom have stayed in Pilsen with her, are Mexican-American, she said, and she considers herself, quote, Mexican by heart, unquote. This next article is titled, Starving Children Eat Animal Feed and Besiege Sudanese City. Hard to read this one, but let's get through it. At least 260,000 civilians trapped in Al-Fashir face a dire choice: risk being starved or bombed if they stay, or raped or killed if they flee. The article has a striking photograph of people in colorful clothing, heads covered. And the caption reads, "Residents waited for free meals in El Fesh, Sudan last month. The city has been besieged by paramilitary rapid support forces since April of 2024. This article was written by Declan Walsh. The reporter reached besieged residents on some of the few satellite internet connections in a city with little food. And this is what he wrote. The city's last functioning hospital had been bombed over 30 times. Between 30 and 40 severely malnourished children arrive every day seeking help. There's nothing to give them but animal feed. Dr. Omar Salik, tilting his camera toward during a video call to show his meal, which was a sludgy paste made from pressed peanuts that it usually given to cows, camels, and donkeys, says, quote, "Even we're eating animal feed. There's nothing else," unquote. El Fasher is the worst battleground of Sudan's brutal civil war. For nearly 18 months, a city in the western region of Darfur has been under siege by paramilitaries trying to starve it into submission. Fighters have erected a 20-mile earthen wall around its boundaries. That leaves residents with a dire set of choices. Stay and risk being bombed or starved, run and risk being killed, robbed, or sexually assaulted. Dr. Salik, breaking into tears as he spoke, quote, "People seem to have forgotten us. Oh my God, it's a very painful story," unquote. The war in Sudan started more than 2 years ago when clashes broke out between Sudan's army and its paramilitary rival, the Rapid Support Forces. The fight has engulfed Africa's third largest country, forcing about 12 million people from their homes, killing tens of thousands and setting off a major famine. Aid groups call it the worst and the world's biggest humanitarian crisis. Since March, when the Rapid Support Forces were expelled from the capital, Khartoum, the group has redoubled its efforts to capture Darfur, the vast region in western Sudan where most RSF fighters are from. El Fasher is the last city in their way. More than 500,000 people have fled El Fasher since April, when the RSF rampaged through Zamzam, a famine-stricken camp 7 miles south of the city, killing between 300 and 1,500 people in what the UN described as one of the worst massacres of the war. A month later, the RSF began to circle the city with a giant earthen baron. That's according to satellite images published by the Yale School of Public Health. On August 27, construction to extend the barum was continued. And the article continues with aerial shots of that barrier built by the RSF. An estimated 260,000 people are left in El Fasher, trapped by the tightening seas. A kilo of pasta sells for $73, 10 times the normal price. Taha Kafir, one of the few aid workers left in the city, said that by phone, his group, known as the Emergency Response Rooms, recorded the deaths of 14 children from malnutrition in the past 2 weeks. Cholera is spreading. food convoys from the United Nations, which has not been able to deliver food to Al-Fashar in over a year, have been attacked by drones as they approach the city. One strike in June on a convoy of 15 trucks killed 5 aid workers. Another last month destroyed 3 trucks and forced the rest to turn back. It's unclear which side carried out those attacks. Young men attempting to flee the city, scrambling over the berm at night, had been executed by fighters, Mr. Qatar said. International aid groups offer help in Tawila, a small town 40 miles to the west, now heaving with more than 600 refugees. But the journey to Tawila is perilous. Fighters roam the area, robbing or extorting fleeing civilians. The road is lined with hastily dug graves and abandoned bodies, aid workers say. Quote, "They are just left here," unquote, said Sylvain Pentecôte, head of the Doctors Without Borders Hospital in Tooele, by phone. Rape is commonplace. The hospital treats about 40 sexual assault victims every week. But anecdotal evidence suggests, quote, "that is nothing compared to the true rate," unquote, Mr. Pentecôte said. Sudan's military has been accused of widespread war crimes, including bombing raids on crowded markets near Al-Fashar, markets that have killed several hundred people. In January, the United States imposed sanctions on General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the leader of Sudan's military, accusing him for alleged use of chemical weapons. But only the RSF has been accused of genocide. And this month, UN investigators determined that the long list of atrocities committed by its troops in Al-Fashar amount to crimes against humanity. An RSF spokesman did not respond to questions for this story. And you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 16th issue of the New York Times, here on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. This next article is titled Turning Against Vaccines, America is a Global Outlier. The introductory sentence for the article reads, "Most governments are trying to fight vaccine hesitancy with science and investment, while the United States heads in the opposite direction." This article is written by Damien Cave. Damien Cave, who is based in Vietnam, interviewed experts from 5 continents for this article. The article begins, "When Vietnam considered making COVID vaccines mandatory for children deep into the pandemic, many parents resisted, fearing side effects and rumors of expired doses. Their skepticism helped shape policy. The COVID vaccine mandate never happened, and it led to greater caution. More parents started scrutinizing packaging to ensure that every vaccine jabbed into the arm came from a reputable company. What Vietnam's COVID concerns did not do was metastasize into a broader anti-vaccine movement like what the world is now watching in the United States. Instead, COVID revived gratitude for routine vaccination. Coverage for the first dose of the measles vaccine in Vietnam reached 98% in 2024. And the vaccine for polio reached 99%. Quote, there was a scare, and that's why there was an almost global commitment to say, quote, we will now work toward making a more robust system, unquote, said Basil Rodriguez, UNICEF regional health advisor for East Asia and the Pacific. He further said, quote, countries are trying to ensure that they strengthen their vaccine systems, unquote. Brazil, Nigeria, Hungary, and Samoa are just a few of the nations that are investing more in vaccination to try to catch up after COVID, a time during a global rise in outbreaks of measles and yellow fever. That makes the United States an obvious outlier, though not because of public opinion, which still favors vaccination. Rather, experts say it's because of the government. Health Secretary Kennedy Jr. and other vaccine critics are now in charge of public health, and under a banner of MAHA, or Make America Healthy Again, they're stripping away support for vaccine development, promotion, and distribution. Florida recently became the first U.S. state to announce an end to mandates for vaccines. Experts say that weakens a policy devised to ensure that in a decentralized and unequal health system, nearly every child could be protected from horrific infections. Kennedy has defunded vaccine research. He has replaced vaccine experts with critics on a key advisory panel. He's limited access to COVID shots, and he muddied official guidance on many other vaccines, worrying experts who see confusion eroding vaccine confidence worldwide. As Heidi J. Larson, who leads a vaccine confidence project at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, how she recently put it in an essay for The Lancet, quote, the USA, long a cornerstone of global health leadership, has become an unexpected source of global instability in vaccination confidence, unquote. The Department of Health and Human Services, responding to such critiques from experts, said in an email that Kennedy was simply, quote, being honest and straightforward about what we know and what we don't know about medical products, including vaccines. But scientists see facts being cast aside with effects that could last for years. The threat is this, quote unquote, the threat is this, that the U.S.-style anti-vax movement, linked to MAHA, wellness influencer grifting and authoritarianism, is now globalizing, unquote, said Peter Hotez, a vaccine expert at Baylor College of Medicine. And he also co-authored a new book titled Science Under Siege. Americans are not unique in having doubts about vaccines, not now and not even before COVID. During French rule in Vietnam, medicines, including vaccinations, were seen as tools of colonization. They were rumored to be used for sterilizing women and girls, fears that also arose elsewhere, including parts of Africa and among indigenous groups in Canada. Decades later, the CIA's deployment of a fake hepatitis B vaccination program to locate Osama bin Laden in Pakistan significantly damaged trust. In China, many still resist vaccination after one of the country's main vaccine manufacturers falsified inspection and production in reports in 2018. Governments have typically responded to concerns both valid and unfounded with outreach and science. Over decades, they've added clinics in remote areas, collaborated with international partners on public service campaigns, and relied on doctors to recruit families. Mandates usually focus on entry to school, have also been common for decades. In a recent study of 194 countries by international academics, 106 nations had policies regarding vaccination for at least one disease. Vaccines against diphtheria, measles, and tetanus were the most mandated, while COVID vaccines were among the least. And you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 16th issue of the New York Times here on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. This next article is titled, Fired Prosecutor Challenges Trump's Claims to Sweeping Power in Lawsuit. And the introductory sentence here reads, the Justice Department gave no reason for its dismissal of Maureen Comey, a longtime federal prosecutor in Manhattan and the daughter of the former FBI director, James Comey. The article begins with a photograph of a woman. Here she is in the caption. Maureen Comey, a 10-year veteran, was among the most highly regarded trial lawyers in the Manhattan prosecutor's office. This article happened to be written by several people, reporters, journalists, by William Rushbaum, Jonah Bromwich, and Benjamin Weiser. And the article begins. Maureen Comey, a federal prosecutor who handled criminal cases against Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, is contesting her abrupt July firing in a lawsuit that challenges Trump's claim of sweeping presidential power. Ms. Comey, whose father, James B. Comey, is a former FBI director, says in the lawsuit filed yesterday that she was never given a reason for her dismissal. She contends that no plausible explanation exists other than that she is the daughter of one of the president's best-known adversaries, or her perceived political affiliations. Ms. Comey is among many federal prosecutors and Justice Department officials who've been fired by Trump's during his second term with no reason given beyond Article 2 of the Constitution. This article broadly describes the president's powers. Some have challenged their dismissals before administrative judges. Others have sued in federal court. Ms. Comey's lawsuit, filed in federal court in Manhattan, names the defendants include the Office of the President, the Justice Department, Attorney General Pam Bondi, and others, and calls her firing from the U.S. Attorney's Office from the Southern District of New York illegal. Quote, the politically motivated termination of Ms. Comey, ostensibly under Article 2 of the Constitution, upends bedrock principles of our democracy and our justice system, unquote, the lawsuit says. Quote, assistant U.S. attorneys like Ms. Comey must do their jobs without fearing or favoring any political party or perspective, guided solely by the law, the facts, and the pursuit of justice, unquote. Ms. Comey, a 10-year veteran who's among the most highly regarded trial lawyers in the Manhattan prosecutor's office, was fired as the White House sought to quell frustration from its base about its reluctance to release files related to Mr. Epstein, the disgraced financier. Mr. Epstein killed himself in a federal court jail cell in 2019 while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. His associate, Maxwell, was convicted of sex trafficking a minor, and she was sentenced to 20 years in prison. The brief memorandum informing Ms. Comey of her termination gave no explanation for the firing, but did cite Article 2. In the lawsuit, Ms. Comey said the U.S. attorney, Jay Clayton, was unable to provide her with a rationale. Quote, all I can say is it came from Washington, unquote, Clayton told her. And that's according to the lawsuit. Quote, I can't tell you anything else, unquote. The White House referred a request for comment to the Justice Department, where a spokesman declined to speak about the lawsuit. Let me take a break from the news and offer an opinion written by, let's see here. This is an opinion written by Ezra Klein. The title of this opinion is Charlie Kirk and the, quote, right way, unquote, to practice politics. To the editor, this is regarding Kirk was practicing politics the right way, written by Ezra Klein. This was a response to the September 13th article written by Ezra Klein. Mr. Klein is wrong in his claims that Charlie Kirk practiced politics, quote, in exactly the right way, unquote, and that he and Kirk were on the same, quote, same side of the continued possibility of American politics. Charlie Kirk dealt exclusively in bad faith arguments, distorting facts, and bringing up the irrelevant, often employing rhetorical tactics to verbally and emotionally dominate his opponent. Quote, the, quote, right way to do politics is not to say horrid things for shock value, as Kirk was known to do. Klein is also wrong to ignore the detrimental influence of Kirk's organization called Turning Point USA, one that has employed, quote, edgy politics, unquote, and demeaning tactics to attract legions of young people to its cause. In what world is this the, quote, right way to do politics? No one deserves to be murdered, nor does anyone deserve to be lionized for fomenting hatred toward others and seeking to dominate and humiliate his opponents. That opinion was written by Ethan Feingold. This is another opinion written and to the editor. Ezra Klein argues that Charlie Kirk did politics the right way, regardless of his views. Mr. Klein thus separates political practice from its content. That is both unwise and dangerous. Kirk was critical of civil rights. He was against LGBTQ rights. He consistently vilified marginalized people. What does it mean to attack these groups in the, quote, right way? Does open dialogue now render any speech or societal good? Speech should not be political. True, but not all speech done freely is good for the country. Klein's focus on free speech done, quote, right, rests on the false notion that maintaining civil discourse sufficiently prevents violence. But this ignores violence latent to Kirk's content. Free speech can be used for good or ill. An effective exercise of that right does not ensure its benefit. Klein confuses the two. When used to harmful ends, it should never be lionized, regardless of its civility. No one should be gunned down for their views, but Kirk's death does not mark the loss of a society advancing speaker. This was written by Joel Foreman. Mr. Foreman is an assistant professor in Buddhist studies at Simpson College in Indianola. The organization Charlie Kirk founded, Turning Point USA, hosts a, quote, professor watch list, unquote. I was placed on this list in 2022 when I was a writer of a guest essay in the Times opinion section. The list was Kirk's attempt to intimidate college professors like me from speaking out publicly about the issues we care about. Its goal was to goad people to harass the professors on this list. Kirk and his list did not intimidate me. It helps that I have tenure in a supportive environment of Smith College. But many of my colleagues hesitate to speak out or write publicly because of the tactics used by Kirk and those he inspired. This list has led to doxing, harassment, and threats against many faculty members. This is not, quote, practicing politics the right way. One more comment here by Carrie Baker. The writer is a professor and the chair of a program for the study of women, gender, and sexuality at Smith College. The article detailed how the National Emergencies Act, which was passed in the 70s when political ethics prevailed in both political parties, had become Trump's favorite instrument in overriding normal law and Congress by deliberately twisting the act's definition of a legitimate emergency. The law has become an open door to presidential authoritarianism. This poison pill legislation should be repealed or severely curtailed. The same might be said of the U.S. Constitution, which is now revealed to be a flawed document full of exploitable ambiguities and dependent on the ethics and restraint of our political class for the preservation of our democracy. We can no longer count on such ethics and constraint or restraint. So, while it may be too difficult to revise the Constitution, it is possible to curb the impersonal and imperial presidency by repealing or sharply curtailing the National Emergencies Act. For the remaining 2 minutes of this podcast, let me briefly introduce an interesting and very successful basketball program. The title of this is Inside the Most Valuable Team in Women's Sports. And the introductory paragraph reads, expectations were very low for the Golden State Valkyries, the WNBA's first expansion team in 17 years, but they captivated Bay Area sports fans and surprised the league by securing a playoff spot in their very first season. This article is written by Heather Knight, and the article begins. Here we go. Fans craned their heads toward the giant scoreboard screen to watch a video of female wing warriors flying over San Francisco. At both ends of the court, flames shot up from behind the backboards. The San Francisco new mayor was in town, in the crowd. A few San Francisco 49ers players and their wives were courtside. Angela Davis, the social activist, who is now 81, stepped onto the court grasping a mallet, then repeatedly swung it at a large bass drum. The sold-out crowd of more than 18,000 people rose to its feet. They cheered loudly the Chase Center arena on the edge of San Francisco seemed to vibrate, and the season, their first, was a huge success. And you have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 16th article of the New York Times here on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Your reader has been Tom Allen. Have a good day.